flick of her hand. Tanner continued. So, Nick, there are incriminating women's panties in your office, where you fucked Andy. And there is Amy's incriminating purse in Hannibal, where you fucked Andy. And there is an incriminating treasure trove of secret credit card purchases in the woodshed, where you fucked Andy. Yeah. Yes, that's right. So what's at your dad's house?
Amy Elliott Dunn. 7 days gone. I'm pregnant. Thank you, Noelle Hawthorne. The world knows it now, you little idiot. In the days since she pulled her stunt at my vigil, I do wish she hadn't upstaged my vigil, though. Ugly girls can be such thunder stealers. The hatred against Nick has ballooned. I wonder if he can breathe with all that fury building around him. I knew the key to big-time coverage, round-the-clock, frantic, bloodlust, never-ending Ellen Abbott coverage would be the pregnancy. Amazing Amy is tempting as is. Amazing Amy, knocked up, is irresistible. Americans like what is easy, and it's easy to like pregnant women. They're like ducklings or bunnies or dogs. Still, it baffles me that these self-righteous, self-enthralled waddlers get such special treatment. As if it's so hard to spread your legs and let a man ejaculate between them. You know what is hard? Faking a pregnancy. Pay attention, because this is impressive. It started with my vacant-brained friend, Noelle. The Midwest is full of these types of people. The nice enoughs. Nice enough, but with a soul made of plastic. Easy to mold, easy to wipe down. The woman's entire music collection is formed from Pottery Barn compilations. Her bookshelves are stocked with coffee table crap. The Irish in America. Mizzou football. A history in pictures. We remember 9/11. Something dumb with kittens. I knew I needed a pliant friend for my plan. Someone I could load up with awful stories about Nick. Someone who would become overly attached to me. Someone who'd be easy to manipulate. Who wouldn't think too hard about anything I said because she felt privileged to hear it. Noelle was the obvious choice, and when she told me she was pregnant again, triplets weren't enough, apparently, I realized I could be pregnant, too. A search online. How to drain your toilet for repair. Noelle invited for lemonade. Lots of lemonade. Noelle peeing in my drained, unflushable toilet. Each of us so terribly embarrassed. Me, a small glass jar, the pee in my toilet going into the glass jar. Me, a well-laid history of needle blood phobia. Me, the glass jar of pee hidden in my purse, a doctor's appointment. Oh, I can't do a blood test. I have a total phobia of needles. Urine test? That'll do fine, thank you. Me, a pregnancy on my medical record. Me, running to Noelle with the good news. Perfect. Nick gets another motive. I get to be sweet, missing pregnant lady. My parents suffer even more. Ellen Abbott can't resist. Honestly, it was thrilling to be selected, finally, officially, for Ellen among all the hundreds of other cases. It's sort of like a talent competition. You do the best you can, and then it's out of your hands. It's up to the judges. And oh, does she hate Nick and love me. I wished my parents weren't getting such special treatment, though. I watched them on the news coverage, my mom thin and reedy, the cords in her neck like spindly tree branches, always flexed. I see my dad grown ruddy with fear, the eyes a little too wide, the smile squared. He's a handsome man, usually, but he's beginning to look like a caricature, a possessed clown doll. I know I should feel sorry for them, but I don't. I've never been more to them than a symbol anyway, the walking ideal. Amazing Amy in the flesh. Don't screw up. You are Amazing Amy, our only one. There is an unfair responsibility that comes with being an only child. You grow up knowing you aren't allowed to disappoint. You're not even allowed to die. There isn't a replacement toddling around. You're it. It makes you desperate to be flawless, and it also makes you drunk with the power. In such ways are despots made. This morning, I stroll over to Dorothy's office to get a soda. It's a tiny, wood-paneled room. The desk seems to have no purpose other than holding Dorothy's collection of snow globes from places that seem unworthy of commemoration. Gulf Shores, Alabama. Hilo, Arkansas. When I see the snow globes, I don't see paradise. I see overheated hillbillies with sunburns, tugging along wailing, clumsy children, smacking them with one hand, with the other clutching giant, non-biodegradable styrofoam cups of warm, corn syrupy drinks. Dorothy has one of those 70s kitten in a tree posters. Hang in there. She posts her poster with all sincerity. I like to picture her running into some self-impressed Williamsburg bitch, all Betty Page bangs and pointy glasses, who owns the same poster, ironically. I'd like to listen to them try to negotiate each other. Ironic people always dissolve when confronted with earnestness. It's their kryptonite. Dorothy has another gem taped to the wall by the soda machine, showing a toddler asleep on the toilet, too tired to tinkle. I've been thinking about stealing this one, a fingernail under the old yellow tape, while I distract chat with Dorothy. I bet I could get some decent cash for it on eBay. I'd like to keep some cash coming in, but I can't do it because that would create an electronic trail, and I've read plenty about those from my myriad true crime books. Electronic trails are bad. Don't use a cell phone that's registered to you because the cell towers can ping your location. Don't use your ATM or credit card. Use only public computers, well-trafficked. Beware of the number of cameras that can be on any given street, especially near a bank or a busy intersection or bodegas. Not that there are any bodegas down here. There are no cameras, either, in our cabin complex. I know. I asked Dorothy, pretending it was a safety issue. Our clients aren't exactly Big Brother types, she said. Not that they're criminals, but they don't usually like to be on the radar. No, they don't seem like they'd appreciate that. There's my friend, Jeff, who keeps his odd hours and returns with suspicious amounts of undocumented fish that he stores in massive ice chests. He is literally fishy. At the far cabin is a couple who are probably in their 40s, but meth-weathered, so they look at least 60. They stay inside most of the time, aside from occasional wild-eyed treks to the laundry room, darting across the gravel parking lot with their clothes in trash bags, some sort of tweaky spring cleaning. "Hello, hello," they say, always twice with two head nods, then continue on their way. The man sometimes has a boa constrictor wrapped around his neck, though the snake is never acknowledged by me or him. In addition to these regulars, a goodly amount of single women straggle through, usually with bruises. Some seem embarrassed, others horribly sad. One moved in yesterday, a blonde girl very young, with brown eyes and a split lip. She sat on her front porch, the cabin next to mine, smoking a cigarette, and when we caught each other's eye, she sat up straight, proud, her chin jutted out. No apology in her. I thought, I need to be like her. I will make a study of her. She is who I can be for a bit. The abused, tough girl, hiding out until the storm passes over. After a few hours of morning TV, scanning for any news on the Amy Elliott Dunn case, I slip into my clammy bikini. I'll go to the pool, float a bit, take a vacation from my harpy brain. The pregnancy news was gratifying, but there is still so much I don't know. I planned so hard, but there are things beyond my control, spoiling my vision of how this should go. Andy hasn't done her part. The diary may need some help being found. The police haven't made a move to arrest Nick. I don't know what all they've discovered, and I don't like it. I'm tempted to make a call, a tip line call, to nudge them in the right direction. I'll wait a few more days. I have a calendar on my wall, and I mark 3 days from now with the words, "Call today." So I know that's how long I've agreed to wait. Once they find the diary, things will move quickly. Outside, it's jungle hot once again. The cicadas closing in. My inflatable raft is pink with mermaids on it and too small for me. My calves dangle in the water. But it keeps me floating aimlessly for a good hour, which is something I've learned I like to do. I can see a blonde head bobbing across the parking lot, and then the girl with the split lip comes through the chain-link gate with one of the bath towels from the cabins, no bigger than a tea towel, and a pack of Merits and a book and SPF 120. Lung cancer, but not skin. She settles herself and applies the lotion carefully, which is different from the other beat-up women who come here. They slather themselves in baby oil, leave greasy shadows on the lawn chairs. The girl nods to me, the nod men give to each other when they sit down at a bar. She is reading The Martian Chronicles by Ray Bradbury, a sci-fi girl. Abused women like escapism, of course. Good book, I toss over to her, a harmless conversational beach ball. Someone left it in my cabin. It was this or Black Beauty. She puts on fat, cheap sunglasses. Not bad either. Black Stallion's better, though. She looks up at me with sunglasses still on. Two black BI discs. Huh. She turns back to her book, the pointed, "I am now reading" gesture usually seen on crowded airplanes. And I am the annoying busybody next to her who hogs the armrest and says things like, "Business or pleasure?" "I'm Nancy," I say. A new name, not Lydia, which isn't smart in these cramped quarters, but it comes out. My brain sometimes goes too fast for my own good. I was thinking of the girl's split lip, her sad, pre-owned vibe, and then I was thinking of abuse and prostitution, and then I was thinking of Oliver, my favorite musical as a child, and the doomed hooker Nancy, who loved her violent man right until he killed her. And then I was wondering why my feminist mother and I ever watched Oliver, considering As Long As He Needs Me is basically a lilting paean to domestic violence. And then I was thinking that Diary Amy was also killed by her man. She was actually a lot like, "I'm Nancy," I say. "Greta." Sounds made up. "Nice to meet you, Greta." I float away. Behind me, I hear the schwick of Greta's lighter, and then smoke wafts overhead like spindrifts. 40 minutes later, Greta sits down on the edge of the pool, dangles her legs in the water. "It's hot," she says. "The water." She has a husky, hearty voice, cigarettes and prairie dirt. "Like bathwater." "It's not very refreshing." "The lake's not much cooler." "I can't swim anyway," she says. "I've never met anyone who can't swim."
"I can, just barely," I lie. "Dog paddle."
She ruffles her legs, the waves gently rocking my raft.
"So what's it like here?" she asks.
"Nice. Quiet."
"Good. That's what I need."
I turn to look at her. She has two gold necklaces,
a perfectly round bruise the size of a plum near her left breast, and a shamrock tattoo just above her bikini line. Her swimsuit is brand new, cherry red, cheap. From the Marina convenience store, where I bought my raft. You on your own? I ask.
Very.
I am unsure what to ask next. Is there some sort of code that abused women use with each other? A language I don't know? Guy trouble? She twitches an eyebrow at me that seems to be a yes. Me too, I say.
It's not like we weren't warned, she says.
She cups her hand into the water, lets it dribble down her front.
My mom, one of the first things she ever told me, going to school the first day, stay away from boys. They'll either throw rocks or look up your skirt.
You should make a t-shirt that says that. She laughs.
It's true, though. It's always true. My mom lives in a lesbian village down in Texas. I keep thinking I should join her. Everyone seems happy there.
A lesbian village?
Like a commune. Bunch of lesbians bought land, started their own society, sort of. No men allowed. Sounds just frickin' great to me. World without men.
She cups another handful of water, pulls up her sunglasses, and wets her face.
Too bad I don't like pussy.
She laughs, an old woman's angry bark laugh.
So, are there any asshole guys here I can start dating? She says. That's my, like, pattern. Run away from one, bump into the next.
It's half empty most of the time. There's Jeff, the guy with the beard. He's actually really nice, I say. He's been here longer than me.
How long are you staying? She asks.
I pause. It's odd. I don't know the exact amount of time I will be here. I had planned on staying until Nick was arrested, but I have no idea if he will be arrested soon.
Till he stops looking for you, huh?
Greta guesses.
Something like that.
She examines me closely, frowns. My stomach tightens. I wait for her to say it. You look familiar.
Never go back to a man with fresh bruises. Don't give him the satisfaction.
Greta intones. She stands up, gathers her things, dries her legs on the tiny towel.
Good day, killed, she says.
For some reason, I give a thumbs up, which I've never done in my life.
Come to my cabin when you get out, if you want to, she says. We can watch TV.
I bring a fresh tomato from Dorothy, held in my palm like a shiny housewarming gift. Greta comes to the door and barely acknowledges me, as if I've been dropping over for years. She plucks the tomato from my hand.
Perfect. I was just making sandwiches, she says. Grab a seat.
She points toward the bed. We have no sitting rooms here, and moves into her kitchenette, which has the same plastic cutting board, the same dull knife as mine. She slices the tomato. A plastic disc of lunch meat sits on the counter, the stomachy sweet smell filling the room. She sets two slippery sandwiches on paper plates, along with handfuls of goldfish crackers, and marches them into the bedroom area, her hand already on the remote, flipping from noise to noise. We sit on the edge of the bed, side by side, watching the TV.
Stop me if you see something, Greta says.
I take a bite of my sandwich. My tomato slips out the side and onto my thigh. The Beverly Hillbillies, Suddenly Susan, Armageddon. Ellen Abbott Live. A photo of me fills the screen. I am the lead story. Again, I look great.
You seen this?
Greta asked, not looking at me,
talking as if my disappearance were a rerun of a decent TV show. This woman vanishes on her 5-year wedding anniversary. Husband acts real weird from the start, all smiley and shit. Turns out he bumped up her life insurance and they just found out the wife was pregnant. And the guy didn't want it. The screen cuts to another photo of me, juxtaposed with Amazing Amy. Greta turns to me.
You remember those books?
Of course.
You like those books?
Everyone likes those books. They're so cute, I say. Greta snorts.
They're so fake.
Close up of me. I wait for her to say how beautiful I am.
She's not bad, huh? For, like, her age, she says. I hope I look that good when I'm 40.
Ellen is filling the audience in on my story. My photo lingers on the screen.
Sounds to me like she was a spoiled rich girl, Greta says. High maintenance, bitchy.
That is simply unfair. I'd left no evidence for anyone to conclude that. Since I moved to Missouri, well, since I'd come up with my plan, I'd been careful to be low maintenance, easygoing, cheerful. All those things people want women to be. I waved to neighbors. I ran errands for Moe's friends. I once brought cola to the ever-soiled Stux Buckley. I visited Nick's dad so that all the nurses could testify to how nice I was, so I could whisper over and over into Bill Dunn's spiderweb brain, I love you. Come live with us. I love you. Come live with us. Just to see if it would catch. Nick's dad is what the people of Comfort Hill call a roamer. He is always wandering off. I love the idea of Bill Dunn, the living totem of everything Nick fears he could become, the object of Nick's most profound despair, showing up over and over and over on our doorstep. How does she seem bitchy? I ask. She shrugs. The TV goes to a commercial for air freshener. A woman is spraying air freshener so her family will be happy. Then to a commercial for very thin panty liners so a woman can wear a dress and dance and meet the man she will later spray air freshener for. Clean and bleed, bleed and clean.
You can just tell. Greta says. She just sounds like a rich, bored bitch. Like those rich bitches who use their husband's money to start, like, cupcake companies and card shops and shit. Boutiques.
In New York, I had friends with all those kinds of businesses. They liked to be able to say they worked, even though they only did the little stuff that was fun. Name the cupcake, order the stationery, wear the adorable dress that was from their very own store.
She's definitely one of those, Greta said. Rich bitch putting on airs.
Greta leaves to go to the bathroom, and I tiptoe into her kitchen, go into her fridge, and spit in her milk, her orange juice, and a container of potato salad, then tiptoe back to the bed. Flush, Greta returns.
I mean, all that doesn't mean it's okay that he killed her. She's just another woman made a very bad choice in her man.
She is looking right at me, and I wait for her to say,
Hey, wait a minute.
But she turns back to the TV, rearranges herself so she is lying on her stomach like a child, her chin in her hands, her face directed at my image on the screen.
Oh, shit, here it goes, Greta says. People are hating on this guy.
The show gets underway, and I feel a bit better. It is the apotheosis of Amy. Campbell McIntosh, childhood friend.
Amy is just a nurturing, motherly type of woman. She loved being a wife, and I know she would have been a great mother. But Nick? You just knew Nick was wrong somehow. Cold and aloof and really calculating. You got the feeling that he was definitely aware of how much money Amy had. Campbell is lying. She got all googly around Nick. She absolutely adored him. But I'm sure she liked the idea that he only married me for my money. Shauna Kelly, North Carthage resident. I found it really, really strange how totally unconcerned he was at the search for his wife. He was just, you know, chatting, passing the time, flirting around with me, who he didn't know from Adam. I'd try to turn the conversation to Amy, and he would just no interest. I'm sure this desperate old slut absolutely did not try to turn the conversation toward me. Stephen Stucks Buckley, longtime friend of Nick Dunn.
She was a sweetheart. Sweetheart. And Nick? He just didn't seem that worried about Amy being gone. The guy was always like that. Self-centered. Stuck up a little. Like he'd made it all big in New York and we should all bow down.
I despise Stocks Buckley. And what the fuck kind of name is that? Noelle Hawthorne, looking like she just got new highlights. I think he killed her. No one will say it, but I will. He abused her, and he bullied her, and he finally killed her. Good dog. Greta glances sideways at me, her cheeks smushed up under her hands, her face flickering in the TV glow. I hope that's not true, she says, that he killed her. It'd be nice to think that maybe she just got away, just ran away from him. And she's hiding out, all safe and sound. She kicks her legs back and forth like a lazy swimmer. I can't tell if she's fucking with me.
Nick Dunn. 8 days gone. We searched every cranny of my father's house, which didn't take long, since it's so pathetically empty. The cabinets, the closets. I yanked at the corners of rugs to see if they came up. I peeked into his washer and dryer, stuck a hand up his chimney. I even looked behind the toilet tanks. "Very godfather of you," Go said. "If it were very godfather, I'd have found what we were looking for and come out shooting." Tanner stood in the center of my dad's living room, and tugged at the end of his lime tie. Go and I were smeared with dust and grime, but somehow Tanner's white button-down positively glowed, as if it retained some of the strobe-light glamour of New York. He was staring at the corner of a cabinet, chewing on his lip, tugging at the tie, thinking. The man had probably spent years perfecting this look. The shut-up client, I'm thinking, look. "I don't like this," he finally said. "We have a lot of uncontained issues here, and I won't go to the cops until we're very, very contained. My first instinct is to get ahead of the situation, report that stuff in the shed before we get busted with it. But if we don't know what Amy wants us to find here, and we don't know Andy's mindset... Nick, do you have a guess what Andy's mindset is?" I shrugged. Pissed. "I mean, that makes me very, very nervous. We're in a very prickly situation, basically. We need to tell the cops about the woodshed. We have to be on the front end of that discovery. But I want to lay out for you what will happen when we do. And what will happen is, they will go after Go. It'll be one of two options. One, Go is your accomplice. She was helping you hide this stuff on her property, and in all likelihood, she knows you killed Amy." "Come on, you can't be serious," I said. "Nick, we'd be lucky with that version," Tanner said. "They can interpret this however they want. How about this one? It was Go who stole your identity, who got those credit cards, She bought all that crap in there. Amy found out. There was a confrontation. Go killed Amy. Then we get way, way ahead of all this, I said. We tell them about the woodshed, and we tell them Amy is framing me. I think that is a bad idea in general. And right now, it's a really bad idea if we don't have Andy on our side, because we'd have to tell them about Andy. Why? Because if we go to the cops with your story that Amy framed you, why do you keep saying my story like it's something I made up? Ha, good point. If we explain to the cops how Amy is framing you, we have to explain why she is framing you. Why? Because she found out you have a very pretty, very young girlfriend on the side. Do we really have to tell them that? I asked. Amy framed you for her murder because she was, what, bored? I swallowed my lips. We have to give them Amy's motive. It doesn't work otherwise. But the problem is, if we set Andy gift-wrapped on their doorstep and they don't buy the frame-up theory, then we've given them your motive for murder. Money problems? Check. Pregnant wife? Check. Girlfriend? Check. It's a murderer's triumvirate. You'll go down. Women will line up to tear you apart with their fingernails. He began pacing. But if we don't do anything, and Andy goes to them on her own... So what do we do? I asked. I think the cops will laugh us out of the station if we say right now that Amy framed you. It's too flimsy. I believe you, but it's flimsy. But the treasure hunt clues, I started. Nick, even I don't understand those clues, Go said. They're all inside baseball between you and Amy. There's only your word that they're leading you into incriminating situations. I mean, seriously, crummy jeans and visor equals Hannibal? Little brown house equals your dad's house, which is blue, Tanner added. I could feel Tanner's doubt. I needed to really show him Amy's character, her lies, her vindictiveness, her score settling. I needed other people to back me up, that my wife wasn't amazing Amy, but avenging Amy. Let's see if we can reach out to Andy today, Tanner finally said. Isn't it a risk to wait? Go asked. Tanner nodded. It's a risk. We have to move fast. If another bit of evidence pops up, if the police get a search warrant for the woodshed, if Andy goes to the cops... She won't, I said. She bit you, Nick. She won't. She's pissed off right now, but she's... I can't believe she'd do that to me. She knows I'm innocent. Nick... You said you were with Andy for about an hour the morning Amy disappeared, yes? Yes, from about 10:30 to right before 12. So where were you between 7:30 and 10? Tanner asked. You said you left the house at 7:30, right? Where did you go? I chewed on my cheek. Where did you go, Nick? I need to know. It's not relevant. Nick! Go snapped. I just did what I do some mornings. I pretended to leave, then I drove to the most deserted part of our complex, and I... One of the houses there has an unlocked garage. And? Tanner said. And I read magazines. Excuse me? I read back issues of my old magazine. I still missed my magazine. I hid copies like porn and read them in secret because I didn't want anyone feeling sorry for me. I looked up, and both Tanner and Go felt very, very sorry for me. I drove back to my house just after noon, was greeted by a street full of news vans, reporters camped out on my lawn. I couldn't get into my driveway, was forced to park in front of the house. I took a breath, then flung myself out of the car. They set on me like starving birds, pecking and fluttering, breaking formation and gathering again. Nick, did you know Amy was pregnant? Nick, what is your alibi? Nick, did you kill Amy? I made it inside, locked myself in. On each side of the door were windows, so I braved it and quickly pulled down the shades, all the while cameras clicking at me, questions called. Nick, did you kill Amy? Once the shades were pulled, it was like covering a canary for the night. The noise out front stopped. I went upstairs and satisfied my shower craving. I closed my eyes and let the spray dissolve the dirt from my dad's house. When I opened them back up, the first thing I saw was Amy's pink razor on the soap dish. It felt ominous, malevolent. My wife was crazy. I was married to a crazy woman. It's every asshole's mantra. I married a psycho bitch. But I got a small, nasty bite of gratification. I really did marry a genuine, bona fide psycho bitch. Nick, meet your wife, the world's foremost mindfucker. I was not as big an asshole as I'd thought. An asshole, yes, but not on a grandiose scale. The cheating, that had been preemptive. A subconscious reaction to 5 years yoked to a mad woman. Of course I'd find myself attracted to an uncomplicated, good-natured hometown girl. It's like when people with iron deficiencies crave red meat. I was toweling off when the doorbell rang. I leaned out the bathroom door and heard the reporter's voices geared up again. "Do you believe your son-in-law, Mary Beth? What does it feel like to know you'll be a grandpa, Rand? Do you think Nick killed your daughter, Mary Beth?" They stood side by side on my front step, grim-faced, their backs rigid. There were about a dozen journalists, paparazzi, but they made the noise of twice that many. "Do you believe your son-in-law, Mary Beth? What does it feel like to know you'll be a grandpa, Rand?" The Elliots entered with mumbled hellos and downcast eyes, and I slammed the door shut on the cameras. Rand put a hand on my arm and immediately removed it under Mary Beth's gaze. "Sorry, I was in the shower." My hair was still dripping, wetting the shoulders of my T-shirt. Mary Beth's hair was greasy, her clothes wilted. She looked at me like I was insane. "Tanner Bolt? Are you serious?" she asked. "What do you mean?" "I mean Nick. Tanner Bolt, are you serious? He only represents guilty people." She leaned in closer, grabbed my chin. "What's on your cheek?"
"Hives. Stress."
I turned away from her. "That's not true about Tanner, Mary Beth. It's not. He's the best in the business. I need him right now. The police, all they're doing is looking at me."
"That certainly seems to be the case," she said. "It looks like a bite mark."
"It's hives." Mary Beth released an aggravated sigh, turned the corner into the living room.
"This is where it happened?" she asked.
Her face had collapsed into a series of fleshy ridges, eye bags and saggy cheeks, her lips downcast.
"We think. Some sort of altercation, confrontation, also happened in the kitchen."
"Because of the blood." Mary Beth touched the ottoman, tested it, lifted it a few inches and let it drop.
"I wish you hadn't fixed everything. You made it look like nothing ever happened."
"Mary Beth, he has to live here," Rand said.
"I still don't understand how. I mean, what if the police didn't find everything? What if, I don't know, it seems like they gave up. If they just let the house go, open to anyone.
I'm sure they got everything, Rand said, and squeezed her hand. Why don't we ask if we can look at Amy's things, so you can pick something special, okay?
He glanced at me.
Would that be all right, Nick? It'd be a comfort to have something of hers.
He turned back to his wife.
That blue sweater Nana knitted for her.
I don't want the goddamn blue sweater, Rand! She flung his hand off, began pacing around the room, picking up items. She pushed the ottoman with a toe. This is the ottoman, Nick? She asked. The one they said was flipped over, but it shouldn't have been?
That's the ottoman.
She stopped pacing, kicked it again, and watched it remain upright.
Mary Beth, I'm sure Nick is exhausted.
Rand glanced at me with a meaningful smile.
Like we all are. I think we should do what we came here for, and...
This is what I came here for, Rand. Not some stupid sweater of Amy's to snuggle up against like I'm 3. I want my daughter. I don't want her stuff. Her stuff means nothing to me. I want Nick to tell us what the hell is going on, because this whole thing is starting to stink. I never felt so foolish in my life. She began crying, swiping away the tears, clearly furious at herself for crying. We trusted you with our daughter. We trusted you, Nick. Just tell us the truth. She put a quivering index finger under my nose. Is it true? Did you not want the baby? Did you not love Amy anymore? Did you hurt her? I wanted to smack her. Mary Beth and Rand had raised Amy. She was literally their work product. They had created her. I wanted to say the words, "Your daughter is the monster here," but I couldn't. Not until we'd told the police. And so I remained dumbfounded, trying to think of what I could say. But I looked like I was stonewalling. Mary Beth, I could never, that's all I hear from your goddamn mouth! You know, I hate even looking at you anymore. I really do. There's something wrong with you. There's something missing inside you to act the way you've been acting. Even if it turns out you're totally blameless, I will never forgive you for how casually you've taken all of this. You'd think you mislaid a damn umbrella. After all Amy gave up for you, after all she did for you, and this is what she gets in return. I don't believe you, Nick. That's what I came here to let you know. I don't believe in you. Not anymore. She began sobbing, turned away, and flung herself out the front door as the thrilled cameramen filmed her. She got in the car, and 2 reporters pressed against the window, knocking on it, trying to get her to say something. In the living room, we could hear them repeating and repeating her name. Mary Beth! Mary Beth! Rand remained, hands in his pockets, trying to figure out what role to play. Tanner's voice, "We have to keep the Elliots on our side," was Greek chorusing in my ear. Rand opened his mouth, and I headed him off. Rand, tell me what I can do.
Just say it, Nick.
Say what?
I don't want to ask, and you don't want to answer. I get that. But I need to hear you say it. You didn't kill our daughter.
He laughed and teared up at the same time.
Jesus Christ. I can't keep my head straight.
Rand said. He was turning pink, flushed, a nuclear sunburn.
I can't figure out how this is happening. I can't figure it out!
He was still smiling. A tear dribbled on his chin and fell to his shirt collar.
Just say it, Nick.
Rand, I did not kill Amy or hurt her in any way. He kept his eyes on me. Do you believe me? That I didn't physically harm her? Rand laughed again.
You know what I was about to say? I was about to say I don't know what to believe anymore. And then I thought, that's someone else's line. That's a line from a movie, not something I should be saying. And I wonder for a second, am I in a movie? Can I stop being in this movie? Then I know I can't. But for a second, you think I'll say something different and this will all change. But it won't. Will it?
With one quick Jack Russell headshake, he turned and followed his wife to the car. Instead of feeling sad, I felt alarmed. Before the Elliots were even out of my driveway, I was thinking, we need to go to the cops quickly, soon. Before the Elliots started discussing their loss of faith in public. I needed to prove my wife was not who she pretended to be. Not amazing Amy, avenging Amy. I flashed to Tommy O'Hara, the guy who called the tip line 3 times, the guy Amy had accused of raping her. Tanner had gotten some background on him. He wasn't the macho Irishman I'd pictured from his name, not a firefighter or cop. He wrote for a humor website based in Brooklyn, a decent one, and his contributor photo revealed him to be a scrawny guy with dark-framed glasses and an uncomfortable amount of thick black hair, wearing a wry grin and a T-shirt for a band called The Bingos. He picked up on the first ring.
Yeah?
This is Nick Dunn. You called me about my wife, Amy Dunn. Amy Elliott. I have to talk with you. I heard a pause, waited for him to hang up on me like Hillary Handy.
Call me back in 10 minutes.
I did. The background was a bar. I knew the sound well enough. The murmur of drinkers, the clatter of ice cubes, the strange pops of noise as people called for drinks or hailed friends. I had a burst of homesickness for my own place.
Okay, thanks, he said. Had to get to a bar. Seemed like a scotch conversation.
His voice got progressively closer. Thicker. I could picture him huddling protectively over a drink, cupping his mouth to the phone. So, I began. I got your messages.
Right. She's still missing, right? Amy?
Yes.
Can I ask you what you think has happened?
He said.
To Amy?
Fuck it. I wanted a drink. I went into my kitchen, next best thing to my bar, and poured myself one. I'd been trying to be more careful about the booze, but it felt so good. The tang of a scotch, a dark room with the blinding sun right outside.
Can I ask you why you called?
I replied.
I've been watching the coverage, he said. You're fucked.
I am. I wanted to talk to you because I thought it was interesting that you'd try to get in touch, considering the rape charge.
Ah, you know about that, he said.
I know there was a rape charge, but I don't necessarily believe you're a rapist. I wanted to hear what you had to say.
Yeah.
I heard him take a gulp of his scotch, kill it, shake the ice cubes around.
I caught the story on the news one night. Your story.
Amy's,
I was in bed eating Thai, minding my own business. Totally fucked me in the head. Her, after all these years. He called to the bartender for another. So my lawyer said no way I should talk to you, but what can I say? I'm too fucking nice. I can't let you twist. God, I wish you could still smoke in bars. This is a scotch and cigarette conversation.
Tell me, I said, about the assault charge, the rape.
Like I said, man, I've seen the coverage. The media is shitting all over you. I mean, you're the guy. So I should leave well enough alone. I don't need that girl back in my life. Even, like, tangentially. But shit. I wish someone had done me the favor.
So do me the favor, I said.
First of all, she dropped the charges. You know that, right?
I know. Did you do it?
Fuck you! Of course I didn't do it. Did you do it?
No.
Well?
Tommy called again for his scotch.
Let me ask. Your marriage was good? Amy was happy?
I stayed silent.
You don't have to answer, but I'm going to guess no. Amy was not happy. For whatever reason, I'm not even going to ask. I can guess, but I'm not going to ask. But I know you must know this. Amy likes to play God when she's not happy. Old Testament God.
Meaning?
She doles out punishment,
Tommy said.
Hard.
He laughed into the phone.
I mean, you should see me, he said. I do not look like some alpha male rapist. I look like a twerp. I am a twerp. My go-to karaoke song is Sister Christian, for crying out loud. I weep during Godfather 2. Every time.
He coughed after a swallow. Seemed like a moment to loosen him up. Fredo? I asked.
Fredo, man, yeah. Poor Fredo.
Stepped over. Most men have sports as the lingua franca of dudes. This was the film geek equivalent to discussing some great play in a famous football game. We both knew the line, and the fact that we both knew it eliminated a good day's worth of "are we copacetic" small talk. He took another drink.
It was so fucking absurd.
Tell me.
You're not taping this or anything, right? No one's listening in? Because I don't want that.
Just us. I'm on your side.
So, I meet Amy at a party. This is like 7 years ago now. And she's so damn cool. Just hilarious and weird and cool. We just clicked, you know? And I don't click with a lot of girls, at least not girls who look like Amy. So I'm thinking, well, first I'm thinking I'm being punked. Where's the catch, you know? But we start dating, and we date a few months, 2, 3 months, and then I find out the catch. She's not the girl I thought I was dating. She can quote funny things, but she doesn't actually like funny things. She'd rather not laugh anyway. In fact, she'd rather that I not laugh either, or be funny, which is awkward since it's my job, but to her, it's all a waste of time. I mean, I can't even figure out why she started dating me in the first place, because it seems pretty clear that she doesn't even like me. Does that make sense?
I nodded, swallowed a gulp of scotch. Yeah, it does.
So I start making excuses not to hang out so much. I don't call it off because I'm an idiot and she's gorgeous. I'm hoping it might turn around, but you know, I'm making excuses fairly regularly. I'm stuck at work, I'm on deadline, I have a friend in town, my monkey is sick, whatever. And I start seeing this other girl, kinda sorta seeing her, very casual, no big deal. Or so I think. But Amy finds out. How? I still don't know. For all I know, she was staking out my apartment. But... shit.
Take a drink. We both took a swallow.
Amy comes over to my place one night. I'd been seeing this other girl like a month. And Amy comes over, and she's all back like she used to be. She's got some bootleg DVD of a comic I like, an underground performance in Durham. And she's got a sack of burgers, and we watched the DVD, and she's got her leg flopped over mine, and then she's nestling into me, and... sorry. She's your wife. My main point is, the girl knew how to work me. And we end up...
You had sex.
Consensual sex. Yes. And she leaves, and everything is fine. Kiss goodbye at the door, the whole shebang.
Then what?
The next thing I know, two cops are at my door, and they've done a rape kit on Amy, and she has wounds consistent with forcible rape, and she has ligature marks on her wrists, and when they search my apartment, there on the headboard of my bed are two ties, like neckties, tucked down near the mattress, and the ties are, quote, consistent with the ligature marks.
Had you tied her up?
No, the sex wasn't even that, you know? I was totally caught off guard. She must have tied them there when I got up to take a piss or whatever. I mean, I was in some serious shit. It was looking very bad. And then suddenly she dropped the charges. A couple of weeks later, I got a note. Anonymous, typed, says, maybe next time you'll think twice.
And you never heard from her again?
Never heard from her again.
And you didn't try to press charges against her or anything?
No. Fuck no. I was just glad she went away. Then last week I'm eating my Thai food, sitting in my bed, watching the news report. On Amy. On you. Perfect wife. Anniversary. No body. Real shitstorm. I swear I broke out in a sweat. I thought, that's Amy. She's graduated to murder. Holy shit. I'm serious, man. I bet whatever she's got cooked up for you, it's drum fucking tight. You should be fucking scared.
Amy Elliott Dunn. 8 days gone. I am wet from the bumper boats. We got more than $5 worth of time because the two sun-stunned teenage girls would rather flip through gossip magazines and smoke cigarettes than try to herd us off the water. So we spent a good 30 minutes on our lawnmower motor-propelled ships, ramming each other and turning wild twists. And then we got bored and left of our own accord. Greta, Jeff, and I, an odd crew in a strange place. Greta and Jeff have become good friends in just a day, which is how people do it here, where there's nothing else to do. I think Greta is deciding whether she'll make Jeff another of her disastrous mating choices. Jeff would like it. He prefers her. She is much prettier than I am, right now, in this place. Cheap pretty. She is wearing a bikini top and jean shorts, with a spare shirt tucked into the back pocket for when she wants to enter a store. T-shirts, wood carvings, decorative rocks. Or a restaurant. Burger, barbecue, taffy. She wants us to get Old West photos taken, but that's not going to happen for reasons aside from the fact that I don't want redneck lake person lice. We end up settling for a few rounds on a decrepit miniature golf course.
The fake grass is torn off in patches. The alligators and windmills that once moved mechanically are still. Jeff does the honors instead,